Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. Your number two burns the hair in my nose, but we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Chapter 12 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Subterranean Pit. Another week came and went, during which I spent a great deal of my time about the pit mouth. I had come to the conclusion a few days earlier that the arched hole in the angle of the great rift was the place through which the swine things had made their exit, from some unholy place in the bowels of the world. How near the probable truth this went, I was to learn later. It may be easily understood that I was tremendously curious, though in a frightened way, to know to what infernal place that hole led. Though so far the idea had not struck me seriously of making an investigation, I was far too much imbued with a sense of horror of the swine creatures to think of venturing willingly where there was any chance of coming into contact with them. Gradually, however, as time passed, this feeling grew insensibly less, so that when a few days later the thought occurred to me that it might be possible to clamber down and have a look into the hole, I was not so exceedingly averse to it as might have been imagined. Still, I do not think even then that I really intended to try any such foolhardy adventure. For all that I could tell, it might be certain death to enter that doleful-looking opening. And yet such is the pertinacity of human curiosity that at last my chief desire was but to discover what lay beyond that gloomy entrance. Slowly, as the days slid by, my fear of the swine things became an emotion of the past, more unpleasant, incredible memory than aught else. Thus a day came when, throwing thoughts and fancies adrift, I procured a rope from the house, and having made it fast to a stout tree at the top of the rift, and some little distance back from the pit edge, let the other end down into the cleft until it dangled right across the mouth of the dark hole. Then, cautiously and with many misgivings as to whether it was not a mad act that I was attempting, I climbed slowly down, using the rope as a support until I reached the hole. Here, still holding on to the rope, I stood and peered in. All was perfectly dark, and not a sound came to me. Yet a moment later it seemed that I could hear something. I held my breath and listened, but all was silent as the grave, and I breathed freely once more. At the same instant I heard the sound again. It was like a noise of labored breathing, deep and sharp drawn. For a second I stood petrified, not able to move, but now the sounds had ceased again and I could hear nothing. As I stood there anxiously, my foot dislodged a pebble which fell inward, into the dark, with a hollow chink. At once the noise was taken up and repeated a score of times, each succeeding echo being fainter and seeming to travel away from me as though into remote distance. Then, as the silence fell again, I heard that stealthy breathing. For each respiration I made, I could hear an answering breath. The sounds appeared to be coming nearer, and then I heard several others, but fainter and more distant. Why I did not grip the rope and spring up, out of danger, I cannot say. It was as though I had been paralyzed. I broke out into a profuse sweat and tried to moisten my lips with my tongue. My throat had gone suddenly dry, and I coughed huskily. It came back to me in a dozen horrible throaty tones, mockingly. I peered helplessly into the gloom, but still nothing showed. I had a strange, choky sensation, and again I coughed, dryly. Again the echo took it up, rising and falling grotesquely and dying slowly into a muffled silence. Then suddenly a thought came to me, and I held my breath. The other breathing stopped. I breathed again, and once more it recommenced. But now I no longer feared. I knew that the strange sounds were not made by any lurking swine creature, but were simply the echo of my own respirations. Yet I had received such a fright that I was glad to scramble up the rift and haul up the rope. I was far too shaken and nervous to think of entering that dark hole then, and so returned to the house. I felt more myself next morning, but even then I could not summon up sufficient courage to explore the place. All this time the water in the pit had been creeping slowly up, and now stood but a little below the opening. At the rate at which it was rising, it would be level with the floor in less than another week, and I realized that unless I carried out my investigation soon, I should probably never do so at all, as the water would rise and rise until the opening itself was submerged. It may have been that this thought stirred me to act, but whatever it was, a couple of days later, saw me standing at the top of the cleft, fully equipped for the task. This time I was resolved to conquer my shirking and go right through with the matter. With this intention I had brought, in addition to the rope, a bundle of candles, meaning to use them as a torch. Also my double-barreled shotgun. In my belt I had a heavy horse pistol loaded with buckshot. As before, I fastened the rope to the tree. Then, having tied my gun across my shoulders with a piece of stout cord, I lowered myself over the edge of the pit. At this movement, Pepper, who had been eyeing my actions, watchfully rose to his feet and ran to me with a half-bark, half-wail, it seemed to me, of warning. But I was resolved on my enterprise and bade him lie down. I would much have liked to take him with me, but this was next to impossible in the existing circumstances. As my face dropped level with the pit edge, he licked me right across the mouth, and then, seizing my sleeve between his teeth, began to pull back strongly. It was very evident that he did not want me to go. Yet, having made up my mind, I had no intention of giving up the attempt, and with a sharp word to Pepper to release me, I continued my descent, leaving the poor old fellow at the top, barking and crying like a forsaken pup. Carefully I lowered myself from projection to projection. I knew that a slip might mean a wetting. Reaching the entrance, I let go the rope and untied the gun from my shoulders. Then, with a last look at the sky, which I noticed was clouding over rapidly, I went forward a couple of paces so as to be shielded from the wind, and lit one of the candles. Holding it above my head and grasping my gun firmly, I began to move on slowly, throwing my glances in all directions. For the first minute I could hear the melancholy sound of Pepper's howling coming down to me. Gradually, as I penetrated further into the darkness, it grew fainter until, in a little while, I could hear nothing. The path tended downward somewhat and to the left. Thence it kept on, still running to the left, until I found that it was leading me right in the direction of the house. Very cautiously I moved onward, stopping every few steps to listen. I had gone perhaps 100 yards when suddenly it seemed to me that I caught a faint sound somewhere along the passage behind me. With my heart thudding heavily, I listened. The noise grew plainer and appeared to be approaching rapidly. I could hear it distinctly now. It was the soft padding of running feet. In the first moments of fright I stood irresolute, not knowing whether to go forward or backward. Then, with a sudden realization of the best thing to do, I backed up to the rocky wall on my right, and holding the candle above my head, waited, gun in hand, cursing my foolhardy curiosity for bringing me into such a strait. I had not long to wait but a few seconds before two eyes reflected back from the gloom the rays of my candle. I raised my gun, using my right hand only, and aimed quickly. Even as I did so, something leapt out of the darkness with a blustering bark of joy that woke the echoes like thunder. It was Pepper.
How he had contrived to scramble down the cleft I could not conceive. As I brushed my hand nervously over his coat, I noticed that he was dripping, and concluded that he must have tried to follow me and fallen into the water, from which he would not find it very difficult to climb. Having waited a minute or so to steady myself, I proceeded along the way, Pepper following quietly. I was curiously glad to have the old fellow with me. He was company, and somehow with him at my heels I was less afraid. Also, I knew how quickly his keen ears would detect the presence of any unwelcome creature, should there be such amid the darkness that wrapped us. For some minutes we went slowly along, the path still leading straight toward the house. Soon I concluded we should be standing right beneath it, did the path but carry far enough. I led the way cautiously for another 50 yards or so. Then I stopped and held the light high, and reason enough I had to be thankful that I did so, for there, not 3 paces forward, the path vanished, and in place showed a hollow blackness that sent sudden fear through me. Very cautiously I crept forward and peered down, but could see nothing. Then I crossed to the left of the passage to see whether there might be any continuation of the path. Here, right against the wall, I found that a narrow track, some 3 feet wide, led onward. Carefully I stepped onto it, but had not gone far before I regretted venturing thereon, for after a few paces the already narrow way resolved itself into a mere ledge, with, on the one side, the solid unyielding rock towering up in a great wall to the unseen roof, and on the other that yawning chasm. I could not help reflecting how helpless I was should I be attacked there, with no room to turn, and where even the recoil of my weapon might be sufficient to drive me headlong into the depths below. To my great relief, a little further on, the track suddenly broadened out again to its original breadth. Gradually, as I went onward, I noticed that the path trended steadily to the right, and so, after some minutes, I discovered that I was not going forward, but simply circling the huge abyss. I had evidently come to the end of the great passage. 5 minutes later, I stood on the spot from which I had started, having been completely round what I guess now to be a vast pit, the mouth of which must be at least 100 yards across. For some little time I stood there, lost in perplexing thought. "What does it all mean?" was the cry that had begun to reiterate through my brain. A sudden idea struck me, and I searched round for a piece of stone. Presently I found a bit of rock about the size of a small loaf. Sticking the candle upright in a crevice on the floor, I went back from the edge somewhat, and, taking a short run, launched the stone forward into the chasm, my idea being to throw it far enough to keep it clear of the sides. Then I stooped forward and listened. But though I kept perfectly quiet for at least a full minute, no sound came back to me from out of the dark. I knew then that the depth of the hole must be immense, for the stone, had it struck anything, was large enough to have set the echoes of that weird place whispering for an indefinite period. Even as it was, the cavern had given back the sounds of my footfalls multitudinously. The place was awesome, and I would willingly have retraced my steps and left the mysteries of its solitudes unsolved. Only to do so meant admitting defeat. Then a thought came, to try to get a view of the abyss. It occurred to me that if I placed my candles round the edge of the hole, I should be able to get at least some dim sight of the place. I found, on counting, that I had brought 15 candles in the bundle, my first intention having been, as I have already said, to make a torch of the lot. These I proceeded to place round the pit mouth with an interval of about 20 yards between each. Having completed the circle, I stood in the passage and endeavored to get an idea of how the place looked, but I discovered immediately that they were totally insufficient for my purpose. They did little more than make the gloom visible. One thing they did, however, and that was, they confirmed my opinion of the size of the opening, and although they showed me nothing that I wanted to see, yet the contrast they afforded to the heavy darkness pleased me curiously. It was as though 15 tiny stars shone through the subterranean night. Then, even as I stood, Pepper gave a sudden howl that was taken up by the echoes and repeated with vastly variations, dying away slowly. With a quick movement, I held aloft the one candle that I had kept and glanced down at the dog. At the same moment, I seemed to hear a noise, like a diabolical chuckle, rise up from the hitherto silent depths of the pit. I started, then I recollected that it was probably the echo of Pepper's howl. Pepper had moved away from me up the passage a few steps. He was nosing along the rocky floor, and I thought I heard him lapping. I went toward him, holding the candle low. As I moved, I heard my boot go sup, sup, and the light was reflected from something that glistened and crept past my feet swiftly toward the pit. I bent lower and looked, then gave vent to an expression of surprise. From somewhere higher up the path, a stream of water was running quickly in the direction of the great opening and growing in size every second. Again, Pepper gave vent to that deep-drawn howl and, running at me, seized my coat and attempted to drag me up the path toward the entrance. With a nervous gesture, I shook him off and crossed quickly over to the left-hand wall. If anything were coming, I was going to have the wall at my back. Then, as I stared anxiously up the pathway, my candle caught a gleam far up the passage. At the same moment, I became conscious of a murmurous roar that grew louder and filled the whole cavern with deafening sound. From the pit came a deep, hollow echo like the sob of a giant. Then I had sprung to one side on the narrow ledge that ran round the abyss, and turning, saw a great wall of foam sweep past me and leap tumultuously into the waiting chasm. A cloud of spray burst over me, extinguishing my candle and wetting me to the skin. I still held my gun. The three nearest candles went out, but the further ones gave only a short flicker. After the first flush, the flow of water eased down to a steady stream, maybe a foot in depth, though I could not see this until I had procured one of the lighted candles, and with it started to reconnoiter. Pepper had fortunately followed me as I leapt for the edge, and now, very much subdued, kept close behind. A short examination showed me that the water reached right across the passage, and was running at a tremendous rate. Already, even as I stood there, it had deepened. I could make only a guess at what had happened. Evidently the water in the ravine had broken into the passage by some means. If that were the case, it would go on increasing in volume until I should find it impossible to leave the place. The thought was frightening. It was evident that I must make my exit as hurriedly as possible. Taking my gun by the stock, I sounded the water. It was a little under knee-deep. The noise it made plunging down into the pit was deafening. Then, with a call to Pepper, I stepped out into the flood, using the gun as a staff. Instantly the water boiled up over my knees, and nearly to the tops of my thighs, with the speed at which it was racing. For one short moment I nearly lost my footing, but the thought of what lay behind stimulated me to a fierce endeavor, and step by step I made headway. Of Pepper I knew nothing at first. I had all I could do to keep on my legs, and was overjoyed when he appeared beside me. He was wading manfully along. He is a big dog, with longish thin legs, and I suppose the water had less grasp on them than upon mine. Anyway, he managed a great deal better than I did, going ahead of me like a guide, and unwittingly, or otherwise, helping somewhat to break the force of the water. On we went, step by step, struggling and gasping, until somewhere about 100 yards had been safely traversed. Then, whether it was because I was taking less care, or that there was a slippery place on the rocky floor, I cannot say, but suddenly I slipped and fell on my face. Instantly the water leapt over me in a cataract, hurling me down toward the bottomless hole at a frightful speed. Frantically I struggled, but it was impossible to get a footing. I was helpless, gasping and drowning. All at once something gripped my coat and brought me to a standstill. It was Pepper. Missing me, he must have raced back through the dark turmoil to find me, and then caught and held me until I was able to get to my feet. I have a dim recollection of having seen momentarily the gleams of several lights, but of this I have never been quite sure. If my impressions are correct, I must have been washed down to the very brink of that awful chasm before Pepper managed to bring me to a standstill. And the lights, of course, could only have been the distant flames of the candles I had left burning. But as I have said, I am not by any means sure. My eyes were full of water, and I had been badly shaken. And there I was, without my helpful gun, without light, and sadly confused, with the water deepening, depending solely upon my old friend Pepper to help me out of that hellish place. I was facing the torrent. Naturally, it was the only way in which I could have sustained my position a moment, for even old Pepper could not have held me long against that terrific strain without assistance, however blind, from me. Perhaps a minute passed, during which it was touch and go with me. Then gradually I recommenced my torturous way up the passage, and so began the grimmest fight with death, from whichever I hoped to emerge victorious. Slowly, furiously, almost hopelessly, I strove, and that faithful Pepper led me, dragged me upward and onward, until at last, ahead, I saw a gleam of blessed light. It was the entrance. Only a few yards further, and I reached the opening with the water surging and boiling hungrily around my loins. And now I understood the cause of the catastrophe. It was raining heavily, literally in torrents. The surface of the lake was level with the bottom of the opening. Nay, more than level, it was above it. Evidently the rain had swollen the lake and caused this premature rise, for at the rate the ravine had been filling, it would not have reached the entrance for a couple more days. Luckily, the rope by which I had descended was streaming into the opening upon the inrushing waters. Seizing the end, I knotted it securely round Pepper's body, then summoning up the last remnant of my strength, I commenced to swarm up the side of the cliff. I reached the pit edge, in the last stage of exhaustion, yet I had to make one more effort and haul Pepper to safety. Slowly and wearily I hauled on the rope. Once or twice it seemed that I should have to give up, for Pepper is a weighty dog, and I was utterly done. Yet to let go would have meant certain death to the old fellow, and the thought spurred me to greater exertions. I have but a very hazy remembrance of the end. I recall pulling through moments that lagged strangely. I have also some recollection of seeing Pepper's muzzle appearing over the pit edge after what seemed an indefinite period of time. Then all grew suddenly dark.
End of chapter 12. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Chapter 13 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Trap in the Great Cellar. I suppose I must have swooned, for the next thing I remember, I opened my eyes and all was dusk. I was laying on my back with one leg doubled under the other, and Pepper was licking my ears. I felt horribly stiff, and my leg was numb from the knee downward. For a few moments I lay thus in a dazed condition. Then slowly I struggled to a sitting position and looked about me. It had stopped raining, but the trees still dripped dismally. From the pit came a continuous murmur of running water. I felt cold and shivery. My clothes were sodden, and I ached all over. Very slowly the life came back into my numbed leg, and after a little I essayed to stand up. This I managed at the second attempt, but I was very tottery and peculiarly weak. It seemed to me that I was going to be ill, and I made shift to stumble my way toward the house. My steps were erratic and my head confused. At each step that I took, sharp pains shot through my limbs. I had gone perhaps some 30 paces when a cry from Pepper drew my attention, and I turned stiffly toward him. The old dog was trying to follow me, but could come no further owing to the rope with which I had hauled him up, and still being tied round his body, the other end not having been unfastened from the tree. For a moment I fumbled with the knots, weakly, but they were wet and hard, and I could do nothing. Then I remembered my knife, and in a minute the rope was cut. How I reached the house I scarcely know, and of the days that followed I remember still less. Of one thing I am certain, that, had it not been for my sister's untiring love and nursing, I had not been writing at this moment. When I recovered my senses, it was to find that I had been in bed for nearly 2 weeks. Yet another week passed before I was strong enough to totter out into the gardens. Even then I was not able to walk so far as the pit.
I would have liked to ask my sister how high the water had risen, but felt it was wiser not to mention the subject to her. Indeed, since then I have made a rule never to speak to her about the strange things that happen in this great old house. It was not until a couple of days later that I managed to get across to the pit. There I found that in my few weeks' absence there had been wrought a wondrous change. Instead of the three-parts-filled ravine, I looked out upon a great lake whose placid surface reflected a light coldly. The water had risen to within half a dozen feet of the pit edge. Only in one part was the lake disturbed, and that was above the place where, far down under the silent waters, yawned the entrance to the vast underground pit. Here there was a continuous bubbling, and occasionally a curious sort of sobbing gurgle would find its way up from the depth. Beyond these there was nothing to tell of the things that were hidden beneath. As I stood there, it came to me how wonderfully things had worked out. The entrance to the place whence the swine creatures had come was sealed up by a power that made me feel there was nothing more to fear from them. And yet, with the feeling, there was a sensation that now I should never learn anything further of the place from which those dreadful things had come. It was completely shut off and concealed from human curiosity forever. Strange, in the knowledge of that underground hell-hole, how opposite has been the naming of the pit. One wonders how it originated and when. Naturally, one concludes that the shape and depth of the ravine would suggest the name pit. Yet is it not possible that it has all along held a deeper significance, a hint, could one but have guessed, of the greater, more stupendous pit that lies far down in the earth beneath this old house, under this house? Even now the idea is strange and terrible to me, for I have proved beyond doubt that the pit yawns right below the house, which is evidently supported somewhere above the center of it upon a tremendous arched roof of solid rock. It happened in this wise that, having occasion to go down to the cellars, the thought occurred to me to pay a visit to the great vault, where the trap is situated, and see whether everything was as I had left it. Reaching the place, I walked slowly up the center until I came to the trap. There it was, with the stones piled upon it just as I had seen it last. I had a lantern with me, and the idea came to me that now would be a good time to investigate whatever lay under the great oak slab. Placing the lantern on the floor, I tumbled the stones off the trap, and, grasping the ring, pulled the door open. As I did so, the cellar became filled with the sound of a murmurous thunder that rose from far below. At the same time, a damp wind blew up into my face, bringing with it a load of fine spray. Therewith I dropped the trap hurriedly with a half-frightened feeling of wonder. For a moment I stood puzzled. I was not particularly afraid. The haunting fear of the swine things had left me long ago, but I was certainly nervous and astonished. Then a sudden thought possessed me, and I raised the ponderous door with a feeling of excitement. Leaving it standing upon its end, I seized the lantern and, kneeling down, thrust it into the opening. As I did so, the moist wind and spray drove in my eyes, making me unable to see for a few moments. Even when my eyes were clear, I could distinguish nothing below me save darkness and whirling spray. Seeing that it was useless to expect to make out anything with the light so high, I felt in my pockets for a piece of twine with which to lower it further into the opening. Even as I fumbled, the lantern slipped from my fingers and hurtled down into the darkness. For a brief instant I watched its fall and saw the light shine on a tumult of white foam some 80 or 100 feet below me. Then it was gone. My sudden surmise was correct, and now I knew the cause of the wet and noise. The great cellar was connected with the pit by means of the trap which opened right above it, and the moisture was the spray rising from the water falling into the depths. In an instant I had an explanation of certain things that had hitherto puzzled me. Now I could understand why the noises, on the first night of the invasion, had seemed to rise directly from under my feet.
and the chuckle that had sounded when I first opened the trap. Evidently some of the swine things must have been right beneath me. Another thought struck me. Were the creatures all drowned? Would they drown? I remembered how unable I had been to find any traces to show that my shooting had been really fatal. Had they life as we understand life, or were they ghouls? These thoughts flashed through my brain as I stood in the dark searching my pockets for matches. I had the box in my hand now, and striking a light, I stepped to the trap door and closed it. Then I piled the stones back upon it, after which I made my way out from the cellars. And so I suppose the water goes on, thundering down into that bottomless hell pit. Sometimes I have an inexplicable desire to go down to the great cellar, open the trap, and gaze into the impenetrable spray-damp darkness. At times the desire becomes almost overpowering in its intensity. It is not mere curiosity that prompts me, but more as though some unexplained influence were at work. Still, I never go, and intend to fight down the strange longing and crush it, even as I would the unholy thought of self-destruction. This idea of some intangible force being exerted may seem reasonless, yet my instinct warns me that it is not so. In these things, reason seems to me less to be trusted than instinct. One thought there is in closing that impresses itself upon me with ever-growing insistence. It is that I live in a very strange house, a very awful house, and I have begun to wonder whether I am doing wisely in staying here. Yet if I left, where could I go and still obtain the solitude and the sense of her presence that alone make my old life bearable?
Author's footnote, an apparently unmeaning interpolation. I can find no previous reference in the manuscript to this matter. It becomes clearer, however, in the light of succeeding incidents. End author's footnote.
End of chapter 13, recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Chapter 14 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Sea of Sleep. For a considerable period after the last incident which I have narrated in my diary, I had serious thoughts of leaving this house, and might have done so but for the great and wonderful thing of which I am about to write. How well I was advised in my heart when I stayed on here, spite of those visions and sights of unknown and unexplainable things. For had I not stayed, then I had not seen again the face of her I loved. Yes, though few know it, none now save my sister Mary, I have loved, and, ah, me, lost. I would write down the story of those sweet old days, but it would be like the tearing of old wounds. Yet after that which has happened, what need have I to care? For she has come to me out of the unknown. Strangely, she warned me passionately against this house, begged me to leave it, but admitted when I questioned her that she could not have come to me had I been elsewhere. Yet in spite of this, still she warned me earnestly, telling me that it was a place long ago given over to evil, and under the power of grim laws, of which none here have knowledge. And I just asked her again whether she would come to me elsewhere, and she could only stand silent. It was thus that I came to the place of the Sea of Sleep, so she termed it, in her dear speech with me. I had stayed up in my study reading, and must have dozed over the book. Suddenly I awoke and sat upright with a start. For a moment I looked round with a puzzled sense of something unusual. There was a misty look about the room, giving a curious softness to each table and chair and furnishing. Gradually the mistiness increased, growing, as it were, out of nothing. Then slowly a soft white light began to glow in the room. The flames of the candle shone through it palely. I looked from side to side and found that I could still see each piece of furniture, but in a strangely unreal way, more as though the ghost of each table and chair had taken the place of the solid article.
Gradually as I looked, I saw them fade and fade, until slowly they resolved into nothingness. Now I looked again at the candles. They shone wanly, and even as I watched, grew more unreal and so vanished. The room was filled now with a soft yet luminous white twilight, like a gentle mist of light. Beyond this I could see nothing. Even the walls had vanished. Presently I became conscious that a faint, continuous sound pulsed through the silence that wrapped me. I listened intently. It grew more distinct until it appeared to me that I harked to the breathings of some great sea. I cannot tell how long a space passed thus, but after a while it seemed that I could see through the mistiness, and slowly I became aware that I was standing upon the shore of an immense and silent sea. This shore was smooth and long, vanishing to right and left of me in extreme distances. In front swam a still immensity of sleeping ocean. At times it seemed to me that I caught a faint glimmer of light under its surface, but of this I could not be sure. Behind me rose up to an extraordinary height gaunt black cliffs. Overhead the sky was of a uniform cold gray color, the whole place being lit by a stupendous globe of pale fire that swam a little above the far horizon and shed a foam-like light above the quiet waters. Beyond the gentle murmur of the sea, an intense stillness prevailed. For a long while I stayed there, looking out across its strangeness. Then, as I stared, it seemed that a bubble of white foam floated up out of the depths, and then, even now I know not how it was, I was looking upon, nay, looking into the face of her, aye, into her face, into her soul, and she looked back at me with such a commingling of joy and sadness that I ran toward her blindly, crying strangely to her in a very agony of remembrance, of terror, and of hope to come to me. Yet, spite of my crying, she stayed out there upon the sea and only shook her head sorrowfully. But in her eyes was the old earth light of tenderness that I had come to know before all things, ere we were parted. At her perverseness I grew desperate and essayed to wade out to her, yet, though I would, I could not. Something, some invisible barrier, held me back, and I was fain to stay where I was and cry out to her in the fullness of my soul, "Oh, my darling, my darling!" but could say no more for the very intensity. And at that she came over swiftly and touched me, and it was as though heaven had opened. Yet when I reached out my hands to her, she put me from her with tenderly stern hands, and I was abashed. The Fragments. Author's Footnote. Here the writing becomes undecipherable owing to the damaged condition of this part of the manuscript. Below I print such fragments as are legible. End author's footnote. The legible portions of the mutilated leaves. Through tears. Noise of eternity in my ears. We parted. She whom I love, oh, my God! I was a great time dazed, and then I was alone in the blackness of the night. I knew that I had journeyed back once more to the known universe. Presently I emerged from that enormous darkness. I had come among the stars. Vast time. The sun, far and remote. I entered into the gulf that separates our system from the outer suns. As I sped across the dividing dark, I watched steadily the ever-growing brightness and size of our sun. Once I glanced back to the stars and saw them shift, as it were, in my wake, against the mighty background of night, so vast was the speed of my passing spirit. I drew nigher to our system, and now I could see the shine of Jupiter. Later I distinguished the cold blue gleam of the earth-light. I had a moment of bewilderment. All about the sun there seemed to be bright objects moving in rapid orbits. Inward, nigh to the savage glory of the sun, there circled two darting points of light, and further off there flew a blue shining speck that I knew to be the earth.
It circled the sun in a space that seemed to be no more than an earth minute. Nearer with great speed, I saw the radiances of Jupiter and Saturn spinning with incredible swiftness in huge orbits, and ever I drew more nigh and looked out upon this strange sight, the visible circling of the planets about the mother sun. It was as though time had been annihilated for me, so that a year was no more to my unfleshed spirit than is a moment to an earth-bound soul. The speed of the planets appeared to increase, and presently I was watching the sun all ringed about with hair-like circles of different colored fire. The paths of the planets, hurtling at mighty speed about the central flame. The sun grew fast, as though it leapt to meet me. And now I was within the circling of the outer planets and flitting swiftly toward the place where the earth, glimmering through the blue splendor of its orbit, as though a fiery mist, circled the sun at a monstrous speed. Author's footnote. The severest scrutiny has not enabled me to decipher more of the damaged portion of the manuscript. It commences to be legible again with the chapter entitled The Noise in the Night. End of author's footnote. End of chapter 14. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 15 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Noise in the Night. And now I come to the strangest of all the strange happenings that have befallen me in this house of mysteries. It occurred quite lately, within the month, and I have little doubt but that what I saw was in reality the end of all things. However, to my story. I do not know how it is, but up to the present I have never been able to write these things down directly they happened. It is as though I have to wait a time, recovering my just balance and digesting, as it were, the things I have heard or seen. No doubt this is as it should be, for by waiting I see the incidents more truly and write of them in a calmer and more judicial frame of mind. This, by the way, it is now the end of November. My story relates to what happened in the first week of the month. It was night, about 11 o'clock. Pepper and I kept one another company in the study, that great old room of mine where I read and work. I was reading, curiously enough, the Bible. I have begun in these latter days to take a growing interest in that great and ancient book. Suddenly, a distant tremor shook the house, and there came a faint and distant whirring buzz that grew rapidly into a far, muffled screaming. It reminded me in a queer, gigantic way of the noise that a clock makes when the catch is released and it is allowed to run down. The sound appeared to come from some remote height, somewhere up in the night. There was no repetition of the shock. I looked across at Pepper. He was sleeping peacefully. Gradually the whirring noise decreased, and there came a long silence. All at once a glow lit up the end window, which protrudes far out from the side of the house, so that from it one may look both east and west. I felt puzzled, and after a moment's hesitation walked across the room and pulled aside the blind. As I did so, I saw the sun rise from behind the horizon. It rose with a steady, perceptible movement. I could see it travel upward. In a minute it seemed it had reached the tops of the trees through which I had watched it. Up! Up! It was broad daylight now. Behind me I was conscious of a sharp, mosquito-like buzzing. I glanced round and knew that it came from the clock. Even as I looked, it marked off an hour. The minute hand was moving round the dial faster than an ordinary second hand. The hour hand had moved quickly from space to space. I had a numb sense of astonishment. A moment later, so it seemed, the two candles went out almost together. I turned swiftly back to the window, for I had seen the shadow of the window frames traveling along the floor toward me, as though a great lamp had been carried up past the window. I saw now that the sun had risen high into the heavens and was visibly moving. It passed above the house with an extraordinary sailing kind of motion. As the window came into shadow, I saw another extraordinary thing. The fine weather clouds were not passing easily across the sky. They were scampering as though a 100-mile-an-hour wind blew. As they passed, they changed their shapes 1,000 times a minute, as though writhing with a strange life, and so were gone. And presently others came and whisked away likewise. To the west I saw the sun drop with an incredible smooth, swift motion. Eastward the shadows of every seen thing crept toward the coming grayness, and the movement of the shadows was visible to me, a stealthy, writhing creep of the shadows of the wind-stirred trees. It was a strange sight. Quickly the room began to darken. The sun slid down to the horizon and seemed, as it were, to disappear from my sight almost with a jerk. Through the grayness of the swift evening I saw the silver crescent of the moon falling out of the southern sky toward the west. The evening seemed to merge into an almost instant night. Above me, the many constellations passed in a strange, noiseless circling westward. The moon fell through that last 1,000 fathoms of the night gulf, and there was only the starlight. About this time, the buzzing in the corner ceased, telling me that the clock had run down. A few minutes passed, and I saw the eastward sky lighten. A gray, sullen morning spread through all the darkness, and hid the march of the stars. Overhead there moved, with a heavy, everlasting rolling, a vast, seamless sky of gray clouds, a cloud sky that would have seemed motionless through all the length of an ordinary earth day. The sun was hidden from me, but from moment to moment the world would brighten and darken, beneath waves of subtle light and shadow. The light shifted ever westward, and the night fell upon the earth. A vast rain seemed to come with it, and a wind of a most extraordinary loudness, as though the howling of a night-long gale were packed into the space of no more than a minute. This noise passed almost immediately, and the clouds broke, so that once more I could see the sky. The stars were flying westward with an astounding speed. It came to me now for the first time that, though the noise of the wind had passed, yet a constant blurred sound was in my ears. Now that I noticed it, I was aware that it had been with me all the time. It was the world noise. And then, even as I grasped at so much comprehension, there came the eastward light. No more than a few heartbeats, and the sun rose swiftly. Through the trees I saw it, and then it was above the trees. Up it soared, and all the world was light. It passed with a swift, steady swing to its highest altitude, and thence fell westward. I saw the day roll visibly over my head. A few light clouds flittered northward and vanished. The sun went down with one swift, clear plunge, and there was about me, for a few seconds, the darker growing gray of the gloaming. Southward and westward the moon was sinking rapidly. The night had come already. A minute, it seemed, and the moon fell those remaining fathoms of dark sky. Another minute or so, and the eastward sky glowed with the coming dawn. The sun leapt upon me with a frightening abruptness and soared ever more swiftly toward the zenith. Then, suddenly, a fresh thing came to my sight. A black thundercloud rushed up out of the south and seemed to leap all the arc of the sky in a single instant. As it came, I saw that its advancing edge flapped like a monstrous black cloth in the heaven, twirling and undulating rapidly with a horrid suggestiveness. In an instant, all the air was full of rain, and 100 lightning flashes seemed to flood downward, as it were, in one great shower. In the same second of time, the world noise was drowned in the roar of the wind, and then my ears ached under the stunning impact of the thunder. And in the midst of this storm, the night came, and then within the space of another minute the storm had passed, and there was only the constant blur of the world noise on my hearing. Overhead, the stars were sliding quickly westward. Something, mayhaps the particular speed to which they had attained, brought home to me for the first time a keen realization of the knowledge that it was the world that revolved. I seemed to see suddenly the world, a vast dark mass revolving visibly against the stars. The dawn and the sun seemed to come together, so greatly had the speed of the world revolution increased. The sun drove up in one long steady curve past its highest point and swept down into the western sky and disappeared. I was scarcely conscious of evening, so brief was it. Then I was watching the flying constellations and the westward hastening moon. In but a space of seconds, so it seemed, it was sliding swiftly downward through the night blue and then was gone. And almost directly came the morning. And now there seemed to come a strange acceleration. The sun made one clean, clear sweep through the sky and disappeared behind the westward horizon, and the night came and went with a like haste. As the succeeding day opened and closed upon the world, I was aware of a sweat of snow suddenly upon the earth. The night came, and almost immediately the day. In the brief leap of the sun, I saw that the snow had vanished, and then once more it was night. Thus matters were, and even after the many incredible things that I have seen, I experienced all the time a most profound awe. To see the sun rise and set within a space of time to be measured by seconds, to watch, after a little, the moon leap, a pale and ever-growing orb, up into the night sky and glide, with a strange swiftness through the vast arc of blue. And presently, to see the sun follow, springing out of the eastern sky as though in chase, and then again the night, with the swift and ghostly passing of starry constellations, was all too much to view believingly. Yet so it was. The day slipping from dawn to dusk, and the night sliding swiftly into day, ever rapidly and more rapidly. The last three passages of the sun had shown me a snow-covered earth, which at night had seemed for a few seconds incredibly weird under the fast-shifting light of the soaring and falling moon. Now, however, for a little space, the sky was hidden by a sea of swaying leaden-white clouds which lightened and blackened alternately with the passage of day and night. The clouds rippled and vanished, and there was once more before me the vision of the swiftly leaping sun and nights that came and went like shadows. Faster and faster spun the world, and now each day and night was completed within the space of but a few seconds, and still the speed increased. It was a little later that I noticed that the sun had begun to have the suspicion of a trail of fire behind it. This was due evidently to the speed at which it apparently traversed the heavens. And as the days sped, each one quicker than the last, the sun began to assume the appearance of a vast flaming comet.
Author's footnote: the recluse uses this as an illustration, evidently in the sense of the popular conception of a comet. End of author's footnote.
Flaring across the sky at short periodic intervals, at night the moon presented with much greater truth a comet-like aspect. A pale and singularly clear, fast-traveling shape of fire, trailing streaks of cold flame. The stars shone now merely as fine hairs of fire against the dark. Once I turned from the window and glanced at Pepper. In the flash of a day I saw that he slept quietly, and I moved once more to my watching. The sun was now bursting up from the eastern horizon like a stupendous rocket, seeming to occupy no more than a second or two in hurling from east to west. I could no longer perceive the passage of clouds across the sky, which seemed to have darkened somewhat. The brief nights appeared to have lost the proper darkness of night, so that the hair like fire of the flying stars showed but dimly. As the speed increased, the sun began to sway very slowly in the sky from south to north, and then slowly again from north to south. So, amid a strange confusion of mind, the hours passed. All this while had Pepper slept. Presently, feeling lonely and distraught, I called to him softly, but he took no notice. Again I called, raising my voice slightly. Still he moved not. I walked over to where he lay and touched him with my foot to rouse him. At the action, gentle though it was, he fell to pieces. And that is what happened. He literally and actually crumbled into a mouldering heap of bones and dust. For the space of perhaps a minute, I stared down at the shapeless heap that had once been Pepper. I stood, feeling stunned. What can have happened? I asked myself, not at once grasping the grim significance of that little hill of ash. Then, as I stirred the heap with my foot, it occurred to me that this could only happen in a great space of time. Years and years. Outside, the weaving, fluttering light held the world. Inside, I stood trying to understand what it meant, what that little pile of dust and dry bones on the carpet meant. But I could not think coherently. I glanced away round the room, and now for the first time noticed how dusty and old the place looked. Dust and dirt everywhere, piled in little heaps in the corners and spread about upon the furniture. The very carpet itself was invisible beneath a coating of the same all-pervading material. As I walked, little clouds of the stuff rose up from under my footsteps and assailed my nostrils with a dry, bitter odor that made me wheeze huskily. Suddenly, as my glance fell again upon Pepper's remains, I stood still and gave voice to my confusion, questioning aloud whether the years were indeed passing, whether this, which I had taken to be a form of vision, was in truth a reality. I paused. A new thought had struck me. Quickly, but with steps which for the first time I noticed tottered, I went across the room to the great pier-glass and looked in. It was too covered with grime to give back any reflection, and with trembling hands I began to rub off the dirt. Presently, I could see myself. The thought that had come to me was confirmed. Instead of the great hale man, who scarcely looked 50, I was looking at a bent, decrepit man whose shoulders stooped and whose face was wrinkled with the years of a century. The hair, which a few short hours ago had been nearly coal black, was now silvery white. Only the eyes were bright. Gradually I traced in that ancient man a faint resemblance to myself of other days. I turned away and tottered to the window. I knew now that I was old, and the knowledge seemed to confirm my trembling walk. For a little space I stared moodily out into the blurred vista of changeful landscape. Even in that short time a year passed, and with a petulant gesture I left the window. As I did so, I noticed that my hand shook with the palsy of old age, and a short sob choked its way through my lips. For a little while I paced tremulously between the window and the table, my gaze wandering hither and thither uneasily. How dilapidated the room was! Everywhere lay the thick dust, thick, sleepy, and black. The fender was a shape of rust. The chains that held the brass clock weights had rusted through long ago, and now the weights lay on the floor beneath themselves, two cones of verdigris. As I glanced about, it seemed to me that I could see the very furniture of the room rotting and decaying before my eyes. Nor was this fancy on my part, for all at once the bookshelf along the side wall collapsed with a cracking and rending of rotten wood, precipitating its contents upon the floor and filling the room with a smother of dusty atoms. How tired I felt! As I walked, it seemed that I could hear my dry joints creak and crack at every step. I wondered about my sister. Was she dead as well as Pepper? All had happened so quickly and suddenly. This must be, indeed, the beginning of the end of all things. It occurred to me to go to look for her, but I felt too weary. And then, she had been so queer about these happenings of late. Of late. I repeated the words and laughed, feebly, mirthlessly, as the realization was borne in upon me that I spoke of a time half a century gone. Half a century! It might have been twice as long. I moved slowly to the window and looked out once more across the world. I can best describe the passage of day and night at this period as a sort of gigantic, ponderous flicker. Moment by moment, the acceleration of time continued so that at nights now I saw the moon
only as a swaying trail of palish fire that varied from a mere line of light to a nebulous path, and then dwindled again, disappearing periodically. The flicker of the days and nights quickened. The days had grown perceptibly darker, and a queer quality of dusk lay, as it were, in the atmosphere. The nights were so much lighter that the stars were scarcely to be seen, saving here and there an occasional hair-like line of fire that seemed to sway a little with the moon. Quicker and even quicker ran the flicker of day and night, and suddenly, it seemed, I was aware that the flicker had died out, and instead there reigned a comparatively steady light, which was shed upon all the world from an eternal river of flame that swung up and down, north and south, in stupendous, mighty swings. The sky was now grown very much darker, and there was in the blue of it a heavy gloom, as though a vast blackness peered through it upon the earth. Yet there was in it also a strange and awful clearness and emptiness. Periodically I had glimpses of a ghostly track of fire that swayed thin and darkly toward the sun's stream, vanished and reappeared. It was the scarcely visible moon stream. Looking out at the landscape, I was conscious again of a blurring sort of flitter that came either from the light of the ponderous swinging sun stream, or was the result of the incredibly rapid changes of the earth's surface. In every few moments, so it seemed, the snow would lie suddenly upon the world and vanish as abruptly as though an invisible giant flitted a white sheet off and on the earth. Time fled, and the weariness that was mine grew insupportable. I turned from the window and walked once across the room, the heavy dust deadening the sound of my footsteps. Each step that I took seemed a greater effort than the one before. An intolerable ache knew me in every joint and limb as I trod my way with a weary uncertainty. By the opposite wall, I came to a weak pause and wondered dimly, what was my intent? I looked to my left and saw my old chair. The thought of sitting in it brought a faint sense of comfort to my bewildered wretchedness. Yet because I was so weary and old and tired, I would scarcely brace my mind to do anything but stand and wish myself past those few yards. I rocked as I stood. The floor even seemed a place for rest, but the dust lay so thick and sleepy and black. I turned with a great effort of will and made toward my chair. I reached it with a groan of thankfulness. I sat down. Everything about me appeared to be growing dim. It was all so strange and unthought of. Last night I was a comparatively strong, though elderly man. And now, only a few hours later, I looked at the little dust heap that had once been Pepper. Hours. And I laughed, a feeble, bitter laugh, a shrill, cackling laugh that shocked my dimming senses. For a while I must have dozed. Then I opened my eyes with a start. Somewhere across the room there had been a muffled noise of something falling. I looked and saw vaguely a cloud of dust hovering above a pile of debris. Nearer the door something else tumbled with a crash. It was one of the cupboards, but I was tired and took little notice. I closed my eyes and sat there in a state of drowsy semi-unconsciousness. Once or twice, as though coming through thick mists, I heard noises faintly. Then I must have slept. End of chapter 15. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.